Welcome to the first day of the rest of your lives. My name is Andy Zaremba, and this is another episode of Vancouver Real. Thank you for joining us. And with me behind the helm today is, of course, Mike. I'm going to point the camera at you.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? Welcome back. Pleasure to be here. And I hope you have an amazing day or night wherever you are in this great world of ours.
Excellent. Yeah, we're having some technical difficulties with cameras these days. And, of course, our buddy Omid Pacman, we could really use his expertise in this area, getting our cameras all sorted out because we only have two cameras going today. That's why I had to rotate it there. But that's okay. The one on the guest, which is the most important one, is functioning well. But as usual, we're recording here out of 70 West Cordova Street here at Gastown Float House, Vancouver. And we've been doing some work around here. We installed three float cabins with a fourth one to come, which are really great for people who might have had a little barrier to entry for, like, say, people who are claustrophobic or maybe had mobility issues. So people who have trouble crawling in and out of the float tanks can just open up these big doors and step in. You can stand up inside them. Like, I'm 6'1", and I can stand up fully inside the cabin. And it's great for people, like, who, again, suffer from any kind of chronic pain. In fact, one of our float ambassadors was just in the center, and Christina, right?
Yes,
Christina was here, and I can't remember. I'm sure she's okay talking about this simply because she talks about it on her social media all the time and gives us lots of credit for helping her out.
Right.
What's her Instagram, by the way?
Oh, Rising Phoenix, at Rising Phoenix Woman or something
right.
like that.
But she posts a lot under the Why We Float hashtag. Anyways, you can check that out. But she has, what is her exact condition?
It's I don't know the exact term, but it's about like hypersensitivity. Like her central nervous system is just, I don't know, like
right.
For example, this is how bad it is for her. And this is why she uses the tank all the time. So like lying in bed when she's having like a big flare up, the sheets on her body are too like invasive. She can't even fall asleep because of just feeling the sheets. Like her nervous system is just super sensitive. So it's something about like, yeah. And it's kind of an unknown, it's very rare, kind of like a one of those probably multifaceted sort of syndromes.
Right.
And anyway, so when she's got a really big flares up, she will come and float a lot. She'll actually float through the night. And actually, I mean, this is a kind of a cool story.
And she actually got one in her home, too.
Yes.
It helped her so much.
Yeah, so she lives on the island. She moved more to nature to get a little out of the city vibe. Got a float tank out there. And then when she does come into the city, because her husband still works here, she'll come and float all the time. So,
yeah
Christina... Yeah, you're an amazing woman.
She is
woman.
A champion, too. And, like, she is just, she's going through such a hard time with her condition, and she's very strong. So I wish I could give her exact, I could probably find her Instagram and put it in the show notes.
Yeah,
because it's totally worth doing that.
It'll be in the show notes, folks.
Anyways, that's one of the benefits of flotation therapy. If you'd like to learn about more of them, check out the video called What is Floating on YouTube, and it's a 7-minute synopsis of all the general benefits of flotation therapy. And if you'd like to give it a try, you can use the promo code VancouverReal, and that will get you a 20% discount on a single float.
And I'll just add on that too. If you go to our website, floathouse.ca, into the Gastown section, you'll see a pop-up widget come up there that will give you your first month free on the membership. So if you have tried floating now and like you want to kind of get into it on a more practice-based relationship, then go and grab that voucher for the first month free.
Excellent. All right, man. Well, I had a nice little surprise in my inbox earlier this year from a repeat guest on Vancouver
Real.
Repeat,
yeah.
You're back
welcome
again.
Welcome back.
I am.
Nicholas Badminton.
Futurist.
Welcome back to Vancouver Real.
Yeah, thank you very much. 2 years ago.
It was 2 years
and
ago.
I've stayed in touch watching Vancouver Real and love what you guys are doing and the other work out there in the community. I was like, it's going to be time for a talk. Things have changed.
Yeah, for
a
sure.
Lot.
And within your realm of technology and global development,
yeah.
a lot can happen in 2 years.
Yeah,
and
a lot has happened. And I think that things are going so fast now. I mean, some people are saying the next 10 years more will change than the next than the previous 100 years.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it's a bit of a byline and a little bit like, you know, clickbaity. But things are changing so fast because now technology is becoming a lot more mature. And that maturity means that you can deploy things at scale, it gets cheaper, can be deployed more, you can disrupt industries that are out there that have sort of ruled the roost for over 100 years, you know?
Right. Just on a personal note for you, you said for the last 2 years you've had 150 speaking gigs, something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All over the place?
All over the world.
Right, and now you're doing a lot more media.
Yeah, a lot more like national TV and radio. Made a documentary on smart drugs last year. That's coming out in May. I can't share too much. It will be on the CBC. That's going to be happening, and we're going to be doing some promotional tours around that in San Francisco, Toronto, Vancouver. It's just gone crazy. Sort of burnt out 1 year. Got some life balance back to the fitness, back to some biohacking. Back in a relationship.
Oh, man, you got a lot going on, brother.
It's good now. It's good. Life is good. The energy I've got, the people that I'm talking to, I stopped trying so hard, and then people started knocking on my door, and some amazing opportunities are coming this year.
Interesting. And if people want to get connected to your work, it's just at nicholasbadminton.com, and they can see all your upcoming talks and gigs and things like that.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Or you just search for my name on the internet, and you'll find videos and everything. Yeah.
Awesome, brother. Well, where would you like to start today? Because you want to come on the podcast because you have some predictions about 2019 and some big trends that are happening globally, maybe nationally, globally, all around the world. So what are some of these bigger trends that you want to focus on today? And maybe we can dive right into them.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's five sort of trends that have got accompanying questions. So, you know, the question is the answer, right? Yeah. we've read some books around that, and there's lots of people talking about how, you know, we can't just come up with like the answers to every single question that we have. We just keep asking questions, getting deeper. But like this year, I'm really focused on, you know, posing some challenges to the audiences. Some of the audiences I speak to, I'm speaking to the leaders of energy utilities in Canada next week in a private forum. I'm going to be speaking on international stage with some international organizations about climate change and whatever. And really, you know, all the doodads and technological sort of widgets that are out there don't solve anything. The business models, how we change regulation, how we change government structures is how we change the world. So these sort of five things that I talk about, and I am talking about a lot in 2019, are things that are top of my mind that are going to have huge impact in the world for the next, I think, 20 to 30 years.
Right. And the first one you had on that list there was there will be increasing tension between technology giants and government.
Yes.
And we saw that definitely start playing out last year.
So we saw Zuckerberg in the Senate. We saw the president of the U.S. that will remain unnamed. He was attacking Amazon and Jeff Bezos. Then Jeff Bezos said that HQ2 for Amazon is going to be just over from D.C. in Crystal City and one in New York City and all sorts of stuff, right? Wow. What's really interesting here is that, you know, why are these tech titans, you know, why are they sort of hitting the national headlines? You know, it's about privacy, it's about security, it's about data. I think that there's an undercurrent here of the current political system telling them to back off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg is 34, 35, right?
Yeah.
Jeff Bezos is 50s now. How old are the movers and shakers in government? The real big hitters, and they're in their 60s, they're even creeping into their 70s. Mm. So it's like a slap on the wrist, not only on their business practices, but to back off with their billions of dollars to try and buy political influence.
Mm.
So this is what's really interesting, right? The big question is, you know, will the continually swinging pendulum of technology mogul adulation, you know, the people that we love, the people we want to work for, the products that we want to use, start sort of ending and with warning shots against their political aspirations, right? So this is something that's just going to be an undertone. Keep your eyes out for it. I think that we're going to see more of these big tech moguls starting to creep into politics.
Well, and it kind of, I can imagine it only, it caught like politicians and governments kind of by surprise, because it accelerates so quickly, it happens so fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, before they knew it, they have these companies that have, like, you spoke about this concept before about big data.
Yeah.
And for people who didn't listen to that prior podcast with you, can you maybe just touch on that? And because that kind of intertwines with this whole thing, right? This big data kind of talk.
Yeah. So the idea that, you know, data is growing exponentially over time. By 2025, there'll be like 44 zettabytes of data created per year. That's a billion high-definition movies. That's like 10 times bigger than it is this year.
A billion.
So, yeah, it's huge. What's really interesting is, though, and I've just been reading about the idea of the panopticon. If you the Panopticon was designed as a prison where one or two people could literally have an oversight of hundreds of prisoners. The wow. idea of when you can have this control. I was doing a lot of reading. I've actually got something here that I want to talk about, which is really interesting. Is that we're in a world where we've got a modern world Panopticon. We've got organizations that are smaller in size than the overall population of the world that want to let you know that they're watching and that they enable you to do amazing things and ultimately they can affect your behavior. Whereas before, how did you affect behavior? How did you make that change happen? Well, you made that happen through like public executions, corporal punishment, war, all this crazy stuff. I talk about how the world's created through war and taxes. Right, and war and taxation, you know, boundaries of countries and whatever. And we're kind of in a modern world where the new world doesn't have those boundaries except for the logins that you have to the systems that are provided to the technology moguls. Right. They're creating a panopticon of the world where, you know, even when people aren't on Facebook or in Gmail or whatever, they feel that they're at least being watched, so they adjust their behavior to pretend to be better than they are, you know?
Interesting. Well, yeah. I think that... I mean, the one thing that's really frightening in my perspective is the social credit system in China.
Yes.
That one is like, because basically they do some sort of computation algorithms, yeah. which triangulate like who you're friends with,
yeah.
what your political beliefs are, what ideologies you subscribe to,
yes.
are you a good citizen, do you pay your taxes, what are you saying about the state, and then they give you a credit rating,
yes.
and which is a certain rating, and if you don't have a good enough rating, you can't go to university, you can't get a loan,
yeah.
you can't get into certain restaurants even potentially, or clubs and stuff like that.
Yeah, so... it's at really early stages in China. There's no one system that fits every single citizen in China. It's mostly run per district or per city, and they're all using different kinds of systems. It's an idea that's being rolled out.
Big so, test.
Yeah, absolutely. So in one particular city, you're given 1,000 points. And then if you do something wrong, you have points taken off of whatever that is and whatever. So you're born.
You got 1,000 points.
You're born, you got 1,000 points. And then, you know, as you go through life and you're a good student and whatever, and we're creating this sort of weird point-based class system where suddenly if you've just been a bad kid, it's going to be almost impossible for you to clamber back up into the good books, right?
Right. Right. So do they have a reward system? So if people act in the correct way, they can get their points back?
I think that there's some element of that. Yeah. But I was just reading an article. It's kind of a symbolic system in China right now. They're trialing it in a lot of places, seeing what right. works. You know, in some of the bigger cities that are more technologically advanced, you know, there's over 500 smart city projects in China. Hmm. Sensors, cameras, the ability to...
facial recognition.
To see you jaywalking or to, you know, to find you doing something that's not appropriate in the world, you yeah. know, and to credit score you based on that. It's really interesting because I'm speaking at a privacy security conference in a couple of weeks, and I was going to talk about this, but because it's so undefined and there's so much hype around it, it's not worth talking about yet.
Okay,
but like in big cities, you know, there's the impact. I used to live in London in England, one of the most extensive, you know, back in the day, one of the most extensive CCTV networks. In the world.
Right.
Deployed AI to help with terrorism, a whole bunch of stuff. I was just back in London at Christmas. Yeah, you feel pretty safe, but there's cameras watching you everywhere, right?
Interesting. It's one of those trade-offs, right? It's like you know, you're being promised safety for security, but yeah. also your privacy goes away as well.
Yeah. What's really interesting is like this sort of comes into the idea of smart cities and how that's being rolled out. I spend a lot of time in Toronto. There's a lot of discussion around the smart city initiative with Sidewalk Labs, which is Google's labs that are trying to build a new smart city on the waterfront in sort of eastern Toronto. And it's really interesting. A lot of people are walking away because, you know, Google and their partners. They want to own the data. They want to own your behavior. That's where the value is. We are the products inside of a technological architecture that's built by these large companies. And this is where, you know, the tension's coming from.
Right.
It's like, hey, we're in this together. I think Trudeau even was on the ground when they announced this. It's a big deal. And everyone's walking away from the project because there's no balance between what the people want and need and what's right. And what the technology companies are bringing to the table and what they want from the project.
Very interesting.
Hmm.
I mean, you think that that balance could be found, because since it's completely uncharted waters, it's like, well, any share of the pie is better than no pie at all, right? So it's like, why wouldn't you try to find, like, and just for the ethical stance of it and the moral stance of it, you know, like, you just gotta, you know, it has to be all in one. Like, when you're capturing data on public sidewalks, you know, it gets really fishy, right?
Yeah.
So what are some squirrely. Of these features of, like, a smart city? What can we expect to see rolled out?
Yeah, so some people, you know, so sensors. So everything from, like, sensors in the sidewalks and the roads, these are things that are already happening today, to, like, high-definition security cameras around. You could even have, like, surveillance drones, electric vehicles, but also self-driving vehicles as part of that infrastructure as well.
Right.
Electrification of the world, so no fossil fuels. I was just reading Guangzhou in China has replaced its 10,000 bus fleet with 10,000 electric buses. They've got 7,000 chargers.
That's great.
So incredibly progressive. China is a huge thing in the world in terms of how things are progressing. When you get to a smart city, you get to an awareness. I actually call it a city subconscious. If you think about us, and I sort of metaphorically think about it as a human versus a city. If you actually believe some of the people that talk about conscious versus subconscious, we're processing about 40 bits of information per second.
Consciously.
About 20 million bits of information per second subconsciously.
Wow.
So in a smart city, consciously we're seeing a few things on the street. Subconsciously, there's millions of things happening at any one point in time that we've got no idea that's happening. Everything from, like, wastewater to how the parking system or the lighting system is being maintained, the traffic lights or whatever.
Right.
And what's really interesting with the smart city and so many things within the systems of the world, artificial intelligence is coming in to mine the subconscious of the city.
Right. You know, I won't get too far ahead, because I end on the question about the technological giants in government.
Yeah.
But we can talk about this first, but what are, let's say, the pros and cons of smart cities? So what are the things that could really benefit us, and what are the things that could be of concern?
So there are some cities that have rolled in smart technology, like smart lighting, smart wastewater, smart parking, like Barcelona, that have been able to generate tens of thousands of jobs and to save tens of millions of dollars every single year. That's a no-brainer to me. But I think there's levels of functionality in the city. It's like, okay, we define a city as needing to be safe. How far do you go with that safety? Mm. In New York City, they've gone as far as to have these sensitive microphones that when you triangulate a sound that goes off that might sound like a gunshot, gets picked up by these three sensitive microphones. If they determine it's a gunshot, they'll automatically call the police, and the police will go to the place that sound was heard. Is that safer? Yes. Could that potentially have some error in it? Of course.
Backfiring cars.
Yeah.
Fireworks, maybe, whatever.
Yeah, there's some drone surveillance systems, DSSs, that can see to see people actually having, you know, what appears to be a fight on the street, and would actually deploy the police to that. There's predictive policing that's actually looking at behaviors, you know, and everything from the temperature, the time of day, the number of people that are walking down streets.
Full moon.
To predict that the full moon, the blood moon, to actually have more police on the street in certain areas. Right. You know, what's the knock-on effect of having more police on the street? There's probably something that's more of a psychological effect of, like, when it appears to be dangerous, people start to perceive that it's dangerous.
Right.
Yeah. And then behaviors are changing. So the pros and cons,
trade-offs, right?
Yeah, but, you know, the pros are really positive, but cities don't know how to handle this yet.
The government, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, we're going into, like, the second trend here a little bit, right?
Yeah, we're into the second. We're kind of blurring the trends now.
And it's all good. We can get into that.
But now with the technology giants versus the government. What are, again, we talked about, like, the social credit system and the potential dangers with something like that, which are fairly obvious.
Yeah.
But what are some other big concerns there, or what are the pros and cons of that discussion as well?
Yeah, I mean, the pros in terms of working with tech giants is that they've got all the cash.
Right.
Yeah. If you actually look at Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, you know, these companies have got trillions of dollars in market cap. yeah, they've lost a bunch of money at the end of 2018. They've still got plenty of cash. Yeah. So they're cash rich, and they've got nearly a million people working for like four or five companies. Right. And I had a really good friend that's gone to work down in Silicon Valley for a very, very large company. They're hiring 200 to 300 people a week. And it's bold. So what's the benefit of working with a big tech company? They've got the money and they've got the people and they've got the ability to think outside the box. Within government, we're a lot slower in how we move. Policy and regulation is in place. There are systems about procurement that are arduous and difficult. There are still some great thinkers, but they're not always heard because they're hidden in the back of, the processes that operate government. And then you've got ministers that are voted in that are pretty much like just normal people off the street that are very, very smart and they care, that have to step up into these roles. So it's a balance.
Yeah, right? And it reminds me of like, the talk about the different political orientations and how they correlate to different psychological orientations, yeah. Psychological profiles. And like obviously the type of people that are, for leading these tech companies are very open, creative, and they have all these resources, where someone that's in government might be a little bit more, just kind of orderly and conservative, and yes. Just a different operating mode of, yes. of human, right? Yeah. And it's always important for when you have these political oppositions or psychological oppositions that they, we're all in this together still. We're all humans ultimately, and they need to have this, conversing back and forth, because if one goes too far versus the other, then that's where, we just get issues, right?
For sure. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was coming to my head when you were talking about that, and versus left versus right. But it's actually the left being the tech companies and the right being the government, almost just because they operate in these different modes.
Yeah, maybe we should outsource government to the tech companies. What would that world look like?
I think that needs to happen on a lot of levels, probably. Voting for one. Let's start with voting.
Yeah, I mean, this gets difficult, right? This gets very, very difficult and
What are some of those difficulties then?
So I used to work for a large consultancy, and countries used to farm out all of their inland revenue taxation, CRS, IRS systems out to these companies to run all the processes. There was still oversight from government, whatever. It works incredibly well if you want to reduce costs, but you also reduce ownership in a way, right? Mm. But service levels and whatever, it can work really well. There are very large government cloud contracts in the US right now, so the government doesn't want to run its own cloud business, so it puts it out. I think the Pentagon was part of this, and they put out the tender, and I think over 20,000 Google employees walked out and refused to work for Google unless they dropped their bid for the Pentagon work.
Wow.
So Google listened to their employees and stepped away. So there's this weirdness that's happening in the world. So it's not a bad thing to have that stance, right?
Right.
I mean, so someone else steps in for that contract. It was like $20-30 billion.
What was their motivation? Was it because they didn't want to have Google in bed with the government to that degree?
Well,
and they're just worried about that?
The Pentagon, the NSA, whatever, right? The intelligence service, facial recognition, that's a big discussion right now. Yeah. Amazon's got a system called Recognition with a K. Google's working on this. A number of other companies are working on this. I mean, there's just been this 10-year challenge from the year 2010 and the year 2019. What do you look like? Some are surmising that was used for training machine learning algorithms.
Crazy.
To actually determine how people age, right? So
what?
Yeah. I don't know if it's 100% true,
it's plausible.
Well, then regardless, they can use it regardless.
Yeah, it's like when you go to log into a website and they say, hey, are you a human? Prove it. Click on the images with a car in the picture. You're just training machine learning algorithms.
Oh, Nick Babington.
You're scary.
All our minds already.
You're a scary dude.
It's all there in plain sight. We just gotta see.
Right. Well, you're not really aware of it. I mean, again, it takes someone like you to be able to distill this stuff down, connect the dots, and explain it. Because when you're just doing your email or just logging into a website, I mean, you're not gonna be thinking about, oh crap, I'm training machine algorithms right now.
Sometimes the most useful things that are enabled by machine learning, like completion of email, sort of text and whatever I use every single day, are just learning when the machine's right.
Man, funny is I've noticed those things get better and better. It's identify the hill. identify the sign, identify the store.
Right.
You know, how many traffic, like, they're getting, it's getting more like, you want to know the hill? Okay, yeah. I'll give you the hill.
That's right.
So weird.
Yeah. And the accuracy is incredible in all the systems. Yeah. Everyone, I would argue anyone that's got a smartphone or anyone that logs into a computer on a daily basis, anyone is touched by artificial intelligence today in 2019.
Wow. So it's here.
Yeah. It's been here. It's been here for a long time, but now it's here at scale.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay. Now that was the tech giants versus government.
Yeah.
Now we dove into the smart cities a little bit. What else do you want to cover on the smart cities?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's about collaboration. How do we work together? I think, you know, Vancouver's actually had a very sort of sane walk into the smart city sort of realm. You know, let's get Wi-Fi, let's get public services, let's get some new systems, let's get some applications. It's very sensible. Some cities like Songdo in South Korea are like, we're going to architect this from the ground up. And, you know, Cisco and other people are there. They put in massive data backbones. Also, Bristol in the UK. So if you go to bristolisopen.com, you can see what they're doing. Massive data backbones. They connect all their critical services. They connect universities and whoever and create that instantaneous connection and services on top of that. It can be incredibly useful. But we just need to understand why we are doing this. You know, why is that neighborhood in Toronto doing this? Sidewalk Labs wants that to be a sort of a case in point of what a city could be. Toronto wants it to be fair to its citizens. There's the tension. What's really interesting to me is that you've got some of the richest people in the world buying up huge amounts of land. And I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be building their own cities from scratch.
Wow.
And it's like, you know, come and live in the city. Sign this 400-page terms and conditions that we can change at any point in time.
Wow. Interesting. You know, what also comes to my mind with that talk is like, because I had a guy in here who specializes in like EMF, okay? And like trying to like, so for example, he'll get hired by people to help them reduce EMF in their bedrooms for when they sleep and things like that. And what does EMF stand for? It's like
electromagnetic
frequency, right?
Right. So anything that's electronic produces stuff, Wi-Fi produces stuff, right? That's so he has these gadgets that measure this kind of thing. And like, because, you know, there are concerns about people being overly subjected to these frequencies all the time.
Yeah,
and like, as you see cities getting more inundated with like this kind of big tech stuff and Wi-Fi just blasting you all the time, I can see that whole industry kind of taking off as well of like, I want to protect my cocoon bedroom so I don't get blasted with radiation all the time. Or
whatever. Was that real though? Is that a real concern?
Okay, so there are a lot of studies stated by people that have this sensitivity that are, you know, in part found to be true, but the parts that are often presented as parts of press releases, whatever, or websites, and some people refute it absolutely. There's such a small amount of the population that has this sensitivity. But who knows? Like, I'm not going to say that they're not truthful in saying that it affects them. I did. It was about five or six years ago. There was a guy in town, and he created something on Columbia Street called the Faraday Cafe. I think it was the Faraday Cafe. And he built a Faraday cage that was supposed to stop, you know, Wi-Fi and electric signals getting in. And we sat in there, and the mobile tower opposite was so strong that it penetrated this barrier. So you know, there's a lot of power flying through. There's actually a house on, like, I think it's about Main and 28th, and above the apartment there are about probably 8 or 9 sort of mobile towers. And I thought about who the hell lives in that place. It's not a good place to live. You don't want to be close to that. You don't want to live under electrical lines and whatever.
Right.
People that do have the hypersensitivity, they get all sorts of you know, linings put in their floors and their walls and certain bed sheets and whatever. I say, if you're feeling it, it makes you feel better, and it's truly physiological, go for it.
Even if it's like placebo,
I don't feel it, but like, you know.
But these phones, even, like, they're not supposed to be directly contacting your body. It's supposed to be like, it says it should be like 2 centimeters away from your body.
Yeah, I just got some reading glasses, and they've got blue blockers on them now, right?
Right.
Why am I doing that? because, you know, you look at your phone about half an hour to an hour before you go to sleep. The blue light affects your sleep. You have junk sleep, and yep. it's not a good world, right. you know?
Totally right. true. So that's a smart city conundrum. Yeah. I mean, I could see that really helping with, like, efficiencies within the city, like just public transportation and that sort of thing, and maybe a safety component in there as well,
yep.
and efficiencies in terms of energy consumption. So, again, those pros and cons are pretty useful. But third prediction is economic protectionism will be rife, and the great global IA ethics debate will begin.
Yeah, so artificial intelligence. Right. We're sort of going deep on this. For the past few years, it's been getting stronger as a discipline. More of the large organizations have been investing in artificial intelligence. It's terribly difficult to hire an AI professor these days because the companies in Silicon Valley and China as well are hiring them.
Yeah.
So I think the average salary for a PhD graduate from a top university, either Ivy League or top university in Canada, like University of Toronto, delivers some of the brightest AI minds in the world. Hmm. It's about 600,000 US straight out of university, up to about 1.2 million if you've done some really interesting research. So it's very difficult. I mean, there are places like University of Waterloo that have put a lot of money down to keep talent there or whatever. The heads of AI at Google, Facebook, Amazon, whatever, they're all from Canada, funnily enough. Wow. So we've actually sort of pioneered that. Now, in terms of thinking about what economic protectionism is like these companies that are centralized elsewhere, some call it recentralization, that they're taking the money from your economy into another economy, are deploying their systems at scale, and that AI potentially could replace algorithmic work. So what's algorithmic work? Well, if you do step one, step two, step three, then you can encode that into a computer. Machine learning can learn through repetition and everything that's gone before it and just do it better. So AlphaZero is a program from Google that learned how to play Go from scratch. It's completely unbeatable. Mm-hmm. Now you've got people that are now you've got systems that can make burgers consistently better than humans. Why wouldn't McDonald's roll that out?
Right.
You know, what value does a cashier at a supermarket give you? They don't give you anything. They've literally, and this is what's really funky about this, is we've made humans robots. And you know what? As soon as you see a human that's in a robot job, a robot's going to come and do that job.
Totally. Yeah. You can see that with self-checkout aisles and things like that rolling out everywhere. I was just thinking of one before you mentioned that one. But, like law and like contracts, smart contracts.
Yes.
Like with like blockchain, you know, because we'll have less need for like legal contracts or people to draw up contracts for us, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that technology's kicking in. What's really interesting is JP Morgan rolled out a system a couple of years ago called Coin, COIN, and they replaced 340,000 man hours of work in about 4 seconds by using machine learning, artificial intelligence, processing of corporate contracts.
Right.
And you add blockchain, smart contracts into that, you don't even have those old systems in place. Blockchain's something I don't talk about too much. I still think there's a lot of work that's happening behind the scenes.
Right. But the potential there is coming anyway.
Yeah, the potential for that technology is definitely there. One of the biggest things that I thought was really interesting sort of came out. It's a year old today, and that's Amazon Go. Amazon Go is the cashier-less, you know, employee-less store.
Right.
The idea of you can walk in, you can scan your app, you can take whatever you want off of the shelves, put it in your bag and walk out. Right. They use hundreds of cameras in the roof, facial recognition. They use pressure pads on the shelves, RFID, and a whole bunch of things to work out what you've taken, when you've taken it. I would guess, and they haven't admitted that it works this way, that they can actually measure the mood when you take a certain item off of the shelf. If you can have this offline behavior encoded and put brought together with online behavior, then suddenly you've got this. You know, why did Amazon just prior to that buy all of the Whole Foods stores in North America?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because 3% of Americans that earn over $100,000 per household live within 3 miles of a Whole Foods. And if you walk into an Amazon Go store, It's very, very smart technology. There's something called fast and slow thinking. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize for this. If you actually look at how this works, reflexive thinking. You walk in, you say, I want that cupcake. You put the cupcake in your bag and you walk out. Cool. Versus walking around a store where you know you have to go to a cashier. You then see that cupcake three or four times. It's either in your basket or in front of you. And you've always got the option to say, no, that's not good for me. It's too calorific, it's too sugary, it's too whatever. I actually think, and they're starting to find, that people spend more money on a per shopping trip basis with these technologies because it's purely reflexes. I want that, I want that, I want that. You spend 25% more than you did last time and you keep doing that. Mm. And suddenly you've got an incredibly profitable business of automated serve yourself Whole Foods all around America within close to the richest Americans that there are.
So are the Whole Foods strategically placed like that based on household income, I'm guessing? Like they place them in very affluent areas, I'm guessing?
Do you know what? It's really interesting. I went to my first Whole Foods something like 17 years ago in Boulder, Colorado, and my friend showed me a $25 roasting chicken. And I was like, I was living in the UK where they're like, they were $5 a piece, right? And I was like, you're joking, right? He's like, no. He went off and spent $200 on Alaskan crab legs. You know, it was kind of like, I was like, what? I think that there's two parts of it. I think that they did choose more affluent neighborhoods. I just think that those neighborhoods got more affluent because those Whole Foods locations were there as well.
All right, so it drew in a certain
demographic. Yeah, it drew in people that wanted to aspire to that cleaner eating living.
Right.
Wanted to, and people wanted to spend more money, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, that's very amazing. So now, how does this go back to like the whole AI conversation?
But the ethics here.
Right.
It's like, how much should AI come into those systems and into our world? The economic protectionism is the fact that we want humans to be employed, right? Humans for a couple of hundred years since the first industrial revolution have had jobs. You know, the 9-to-5, 5-day work week comes from the idea of earning money and then having the weekend to spend money and then one day in church or one morning in church as well. And that's being created as a system. Now, our entire world is built that way in the Western world. So I don't know of any government, certainly in the Western world, I actually don't know any government around the world that's prepared for the mass automation of certain kinds of industries. So, for example, if you suddenly got, there are like probably hundreds of millions of Chinese working in factories. If suddenly you deploy at scale artificial intelligence and robotics to replace them, that's a huge economic hit for the country. That's starving people. That's a major, humanitarian crisis.
Right.
I actually think you look at the Midwest in America, central Canada, places, whatever, not the coasts. You've got a problem when a lot of these industries are being undertaken by, robotics and artificial intelligence. I've had some really heartening stories over the past year or so where people have actually brought robots into their factories and they turn them off when they don't need them. And when they do need them, they've worked out a way of the human working with the machine. That's actually the future. Hmm. We will be working with robotics and artificial intelligence. The wisdom that we will bring and the creativity, the problem solving will be what we do as humans. No one should be making a sandwich for another human. Someone should be designing a sandwich for another human based on their tastes and in a lovely conversation and then telling a machine to make it for it. It's a very basic and kind of a little bit of a dumb example, but this is what's going to happen. It's the idea that, in a port, in a busy port, you could replace humans with automated lorries, machinery, loading bays and whatever. Still, humans are going to be the grease that makes these systems run a lot faster.
Hmm. Right.
But the thing is that we're not going to need as many people doing those jobs.
Right.
So no country is ready for this. And in the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be some very tough talks happening, especially around manual labor, around very basic algorithmic work.
Like how many jobs are gone, say, like taxi drivers, truck drivers?
Yeah.
Delivery, anyone in delivery of any kind, basically. Yeah.
I can tell you this for Canada. I did a presentation last year to the Automotive Association in Canada. So I worked out there's 500,000 people that drive taxis, drive trucks, and do some sort of commercial driving in Canada that could all be put out of work within 5 to 10 years with automated vehicles.
Wow.
But then I also turned around and I said, 10% of immigrant taxi drivers have got degrees. And there was something like 200 of them were like trained surgeons.
Sure.
So we're getting it wrong as well from a country perspective of not putting people in the right place in society or giving them the chance that they need through over-regulation or whatever. And it's like...
Mm. Not recognizing their degree or whatever it happens.
How many Uber drivers like have I spoken to in the last 6 or 7 years that are literally like doing their PhD, got their PhD, they're trying to make ends meet in a world where we need them more than ever, and they're driving a car. It's crazy. This is where the ethics debates come in. It's like, how do we loosen up our society so all the people with talent can get into positions where they can help society, and we can roll in artificial intelligence, robotics, and automation systems to replace the dumb work?
Do you have any solutions for that? Like, how to get those people pushed in? Like, I mean, I guess you'd have to have some sort of like standardized testing for, say, like, let's say the surgeon.
Yeah.
Does he have the right requirements to be a surgeon according to our standards? And then could that be like, instead of going through a whole, you know, 10-year education system to get to that point, could they just test him and be like, oh, yes, he's fully qualified, plug him in?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I total speculation there, but.
Yeah, do I have solutions? So this is where it gets really tough. There needs to be a wholesale redefinition of what the education system looks like, and we're going to talk about that in a little while.
Yeah.
What the education system looks like, but also, you know, what value is determined to be within a modern work context as well. Some people are saying that 65% of jobs that kids will do, you know, in the following few years after they graduate, don't even exist today. It's because things are going to change. You know, things are going to be a lot more softer skills, or there's going to be a lot more strategy-based work, or what I call wisdom-based work in the wisdom economy. Hmm. And I think that...
Can you define the wisdom economy a little bit?
Yeah. So, okay. So if we look at... There's an old hierarchy of information. At the bottom is data. Data that becomes information, which is usable, that becomes knowledge. It's got a narrative around it. And above that is wisdom, which is, it's been applied. We've learned from that. We now store that. The next time we do something, we can apply our wisdom to a situation. It makes things easier and better. It's called experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're moving up the chain. Now, AI, take care of data. No one have to like pull data and create spreadsheets, seriously. Information, okay, it could add a bit of a narrative. Knowledge, that's when humans and the machines start to work together to build a narrative that's useful for strategic thinking. Wisdom is something that is really hard for computers to encode because it's based on all of this experience, but practically applied to very complicated systems. You know, complex systems like cities and people and whatever.
Mm.
You know, an emotional reaction across 100 people that we interact with in a year.
Right.
We learn from that, and how we speak about a topic or how we say hi or whatever. Computers are awful at even trying to work that out. It's a one-size-fits-all sort of situation for them.
So you're never going to see like the AI or robot, say, psychologist or a counselor.
Some people are saying that there's a potential for that. There's been a lot of tests with the Turing test or whatever that have tried to use like the online psychologist. Is it a human? Is it not a human? Mm. Whatever. Mm. That's happened before. Will we see them? I think the lower level, you know, question and answer, sure. The deeper level understanding of who we are, you know, philosophically, metaphorically, and from a psychological basis, is going to be something that is still going to need humans. Mm. In fact, if you think about it, you're probably going to need more people to do that in the future.
Because people will be lost because they have no jobs and no meaning and no purpose.
Yeah, mental health is really, you know, in decline as technology, as you know, social media, the way that we interact in the world, people are lonelier.
Right.
How do we deal with that? No, we're more connected, but we're more connected in a way where literally, you know, we're all sat in we're sat in the airport lounge and we're all staring at our phone, right?
Right. Yeah.
So back to the, what we were talking about, the AI problem in terms of putting people out of work.
Yeah.
Now, we've heard things kicked around like, say, universal basic income
yes.
as a potential solution for something like that.
Yeah.
Is that feasible, or is that something that's, you know, it sounds nice, but maybe wouldn't really work?
So universal basic income has been something that's been flying around for a long time. There was an experiment about 40 years ago in Dauphin, Manitoba. For a couple of years, it worked really well. People were given a certain amount of dollars on a monthly basis, regardless of who they were. They ended up after 2 years being healthier, working harder, just being like happier in life. The program was pulled because the government changed. Nice one. There goes politics again, right? Now there's a lot more experiments. This is what people are getting wrong. UBI is not going to replace income. It's not going to suddenly be the calamine lotion of you don't have a salary anymore. It's not going to be like that. But there's some positive effects that they found of universal basic income solving what the social security system is.
Right.
So social security is generally like, there's taxation, part of that goes towards social security, gets dispersed to people that do not have
income,
yeah. Right? For housing, for food, or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very very segregated system. You get that. We determine how much you get. You have to live within those boundaries. It's very difficult for those people to come out. What people have found with UBI and the places that they've done experiments with it, they've been able to deploy X thousand dollars or whatever per month to everyone. Everyone comes up to a level and standard of living together. As a standard. And it's actually, I think the UBI is a potential way to fund our way out of poverty into a more equal world.
Right.
So it's not like, I'm going to get paid even though I can't get a job because a robot's got a job. It's not like that.
Right.
Because we're still going to do work. In fact, we're going to work, you know, people could even build their own businesses because suddenly they've got more freedom in their life or whatever.
Right.
I think it's something that should be taken a lot more seriously by government.
Well, it's true. I mean, even in Canada, because we have more of a social safety net, we actually have higher rates of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Simply because people can afford to take more risks, whereas like we, you know, in Canada, for the most part, you're going to have shelter, you know, food, healthcare. You know, you got more or less covered. Whereas in the States, you lose your job, your healthcare is essentially gone, your income's gone. So people are less prone to taking a risk. You have less entrepreneurship.
Yeah. I mean, think about the federal workers that aren't being paid and haven't been paid for a long time now, 3-4 weeks now.
Right. Yes.
Like, do you know what? A lot of businesses are stepping up to help them because they know that they're good people, but they know what the effects of those people suddenly not feeding spending. Their families not whatever, like wholly on the economy and their own health and the whole infrastructure of care and poverty and all these other things sort of impacted. Yeah.
Anything else you want to touch on within the AI ethical debates realm?
Not really, because it sort of pops up everywhere. It's like, what is right? What's the right thing to do? Mm-hmm. And it's so blurred. Does everyone deserve to have a job? Sure. Should everyone be a cashier at McDonald's? No one should be a cashier at McDonald's.
Ideally.
Discuss.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But some people don't have the education to do more of that. How do you fix that? Ethically, so complicated. We could talk about that for 25 hours.
So, fourth prediction.
Yeah.
The reinvention of education starts and the talent pooling from fifth grade and earlier will begin.
Yeah.
So, talent pooling, interesting.
Yeah, so some people are saying that the biggest companies in the world by 2030 will be companies focused on education. Hmm. Because we do have this automation, because we do have this changing world, because we have changing dynamics, we're actually going to have to teach our kids in a different way. But adults are also going to have to be trained. So kids and how they get educated, it's going to have to change. It hasn't changed for a long, long time. I failed at school, failed miserably at school. It wasn't made for me. It wasn't my way of learning. I'm a divergent thinker. It didn't work well. Some people did really, really well. I'm much more practical, the way that I do thinking. I went on to do a degree or whatever. It fit me once I got there.
Right.
Kids these days, it's a one-size-fits-all sort of approach. And then when you get to adults, retraining is really hard. Alvin Toffler, who's a very famous futurist, he wrote Future Shock in the 70s, said this, the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn.
Yeah.
So we're going to have, and I've had a lot of people say this, we're going to have 50-year-olds, like 55-year-olds, that are going to have to do micro degrees or retraining so that they've got an ability to do something else. Mm-hmm. And that's going to happen all the way from when you graduate university or school all the way up until we die, because, you know, retirement's going to be a bygone thing.
And you think that's largely because of the rate of technological advancement then?
I mean, that it's the rate of technological advancement is, I mean, the education, sorry, the technological landscape is changing so drastically. The people that can really help those large companies accelerate faster are getting fewer and thinner on the ground. Mm. This was even happening to me like 25 years ago when I got one of my first jobs. And this is a true story. In London, there was a company. It was formed out of MIT. It was based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river from Boston, just by MIT. It used to employ people from Harvard and MIT and Ivy League schools in America. Cool. In London, it was employing as many Oxford and Cambridge students, graduates, as they could. You know, the banks and large management consultancies came first. They soon ran out of people to hire. And then they started hiring people like me that went to a lower graded university, but did some very, very smart things with psychology and computing, AI and the such like. And that business boomed. Hmm. So what was really interesting to me to think about that and where we are today is that we're in the same sort of starvation around the amount of talent that's available. You have companies like Google or whoever growing at 250 people a week. You know, Amazon's one of the biggest employers in America, and it's gonna keep growing and growing. All these companies are gonna keep growing. So where do you find the talent? You don't find it from the other companies necessarily. You find it in grade five. And then you pay for that kid to go through school. You help that family out. That kid's almost becomes a breadwinner. You know, better education, better nutrition, more opportunities. And suddenly at the age of 21, maybe even younger, because they may not even bother going to university, they're like top coders or strategists or whoever, right, for these technology companies. Mm. Why wouldn't you do it? It's the same as, like, you know, you find a kid that can play hockey.
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
How old was Wayne Gretzky when he was found?
Who knows? Five.
Yeah. So young. Ridiculous. Yeah. But like raw, absolute talent. Right. I actually think that applies to the technological realm.
It's interesting because I was thinking there, like, well, you know, I was kind of getting, my critical mind was thinking, like, well, you know, you're kind of robbing this child of their own freedom to choose and all this kind of stuff. But I'm like, man, we do that with sports all the time.
Yeah.
And it's because we put such a high value on the sports process, and the kids kind of get sucked into that momentum. We're like, I got to do this. And by the time they're 12 or 13, if they're like a high achiever, well, then they're put through, you know, the top tier experiences to develop them, right? But you're right.
Like, and do you know what? It's not even going to be about whether that kid's going to definitely work for the company when they reach 18 or whether they reach 21. Because they'll come back eventually.
Right.
So a kid's just as valuable if, say, he's trained by Amazon up until the age of 21. And he goes, you know what? I don't want to work in Amazon right now. They're like, cool, we're always going to be here. They go and have a bunch of other experience and then come into Amazon. He's even more valuable.
Right. Right. And the thing about it, too, is people are generally happier when they're doing something that they're very good at and very competent at.
Yeah.
So it's like matching children with their skills earlier is going to set them up for success for their entire life, potentially. Yeah, go have your exploration, like 20 to 25, whatever. Go traveling for 5 years. Come back, and then we'll plug you in where you'll be a good fit.
Yeah.
But now where's the ethical dilemma and debates come in play with this whole situation?
Well, it's like, how closely should you let your child play with large companies? But from such a foundational element as education is, how closely do you let them like fly to the close to the flame?
Hmm.
You know?
Right.
I mean, that's it. You can boost them up and boost them up. What does... You know, what does a situation where you're going through a work-based program and you're not performing look like for a kid when that kid is bringing in, say, $2,000 a month to the family income because they're a Google...
Prodigy.
They're a Google... they'd probably call it that. Yeah, do you know? And it suddenly, here's the ethical debates. Because, you can't abandon kids in dreams. We know what happens, right? When I was 14 years old, I had to choose my GCSEs in the UK. And I was like, I want to do computers. They said, you can't because we don't have any more space in the class. I'm like, it's like the one thing that I accept.
And then you're just like, I'm done with this.
Yeah, and so I didn't bother.
Yeah.
I did all sorts of cool stuff in technology and physics. Everything else was absolute garbage. And I walked out with almost nothing. And I was still hacking away at computers and doing that. Spent 2 years doing algorithmic work that was useless and dead end. And then went back to, you know, do computer-based courses, got distinctions, whatever. Ended up working in AI. It's like...
Do you think this will be a decision that parents will have to make in the future then about their kids? Like, should I let my child be educated by this corporation?
Yeah, I think it'll be a lot more collaborative. I think the parents will work with their kids to work out what's best for the kids, you know.
Right.
I think we have to let go of the idea that our children are an extension of who we are and we want them to live the life that we expect them to live and to have a little bit more open mind, you know.
Right.
Kids are smart, right?
Yeah.
So yes, it will be a decision. Yes, it should be collaborative. Yes, it will likely be engendered through a school system. Yes, there'll be alternative versions of the school system as well. People like Elon Musk have created their own school. There's something called alt schools down in the States as well that have a different approach. You know, grades don't exist. What they learn at school is more like how to solve problems, how to be an entrepreneur. Why aren't we teaching kids at the age of 14, 15 how to set up their businesses and make money?
Sure.
And build the economy?
Yeah.
No, we're teaching them trigonometry when they don't even want to be a cartographer.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
This is my problem with mathematics.
You don't want to make maps? Right. Come on.
But this is it, right? And that's how my brain was working. I was like, I'm never going to need all of this. My maths is still pretty bad. Yeah. I can do my accounting.
That's not your job anymore.
Yeah. It's not my job anymore.
No. So... last prediction, the fight for Africa will heat up. What's going on there?
Okay, so it's really, really interesting. 1.2 billion people, and it's the second most populous continent, right, behind Asia, right? It's got the largest growing middle class in the world. Over the years, it's going to grow so strong. More people are going to be born in Africa, are going to build businesses in Africa, whatever. They're actually thinking that by 2022, sub-Saharan Africa will aim for a 486% GDP growth since 2000. Middle East, North Africa, 258% versus the rest of the world, which is like 205% of growth since the year 2000.
Wow, this explosion.
Africa is exploding. That is where the next billion users of any tech system is. Is in Africa. It's going to be such a hotbed. As renewable energy is heating up, it's going to be a major center for renewable energy. Both America and China are going in and starting to buy up land a lot. And they're helping, you know, China especially is building infrastructure off their own backs for Africa. Why? Because they want to own natural resources. They want to, this is kind of messed up. They want to own the aquifer. They want to own water resources. Actually, Michael Burry, the guy who was from The Big Short, you know, that shorted the housing market, is now focused on investing in agriculture and water-based resources because that's going to be the next huge growth in the world. People like Bill Gates are and whatever. He's one of the largest agricultural landowners in North America now. So back to Africa, China and America are investing a lot of money. And they're at loggerheads, but China's winning the battle.
Now, are these like the corporations?
They're investing at nation level, infrastructure at nation level. And people like the World Bank are investing a huge amount of money as well. Africa is the hotbed. I was just in Morocco 3 weeks ago, and it's still basic living. About 20,000 people in Marrakesh still don't have like electricity or running water. It's still basic living. But they've got 2,000-year-old methods of running irrigation and water systems from the Atlas Mountains into the city. Incredibly bright, incredibly progressive places that have sort of been caught up in a modern world. But that modern world's going to accelerate through these places as well. And it's just going to be incredible. If you've ever met a really driven African entrepreneur, they're incredible. Like, smart, so very smart. Ruthless, not ruthless. Brave, focused, really. I used to live next door to a guy from Ghana, and he was just an inspiration.
It's just like relentless, like just
like, yeah. It's like, it's like I've got nothing but opportunity. Right. I've got, you know, I just want to make the world a better place. I want to make money. I want to build organizations. I think you're going to see Africa as being this strong continent. I think it's going to be one of the world centers for energy production and distribution, and that's going to be paid for by China.
Wow.
My big prediction is in 2019 is that China will pour more and more money, way more money than America will, because America's taken their eye off of every ball.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really going to take over that continent in terms of ownership.
Wow. That's
yeah.
huge. That'll change a lot.
Yeah. And it's... So I've got another stat here. Africa will account for half of global population growth by 2050. And I think I was saying to you guys some stats. I don't always believe all statistics. I just want to say that. But like when I read these things, it's like, is this true? Because 10 of the largest cities in the world by 2100 will be in Africa and India. People are saying Lagos, Nigeria, is the fastest growing city in Africa. They think it's going to be 88.3 million people by 2100.
So crazy.
Wow.
What power is that? We know that urban systems, people in one place.
Right.
You can influence, you can use them, workforce, smart people, entrepreneurship,
yep.
whatever.
Economies,
money. Also control, the ability to be part of our system, servicing them, whatever. Smart cities, everything I've spoken about before this.
Right.
Yeah,
we're heading towards a very interesting world.
Okay.
I mean, I was in North Africa and it was just overwhelming to me. It's so, and that's not even other parts of Africa that are even more rural or you know have got even tougher times.
Right.
It's a trip.
Wow.
It's fun.
And it's going to probably just, like once they got that kind of political stability or support, like however that stuff went happen. I'm sure every country is kind of unique, but it seems like once they kind of got that, then it's like, okay, now we're, kind of economic or politically stable. So it's like you just kind of get a trampoline effect into now the day and age of technology here.
Yeah.
Right. Leapfrogging sort of technology.
Yes, right.
Technological advances, and they just plug themselves right into this high-tech world.
And you know what? The African leaders are going to look to the people that stood by them when no one else believed. China.
Wow.
And America a little bit.
Yeah. But China's going to, you think China's going to, quote unquote, win that race?
I think they are winning the race. They've spent $75 billion on infrastructure since 2009 in China. Just on infrastructure. We're going to help you guys out.
Wow.
It buys you a lot of friendship, right?
Yeah.
Like the Democratic Republic of Congo is one of the most disputed countries down there in terms of like who owns what land. China own a lot of it.
Wow.
And why? Because they own the water.
Do you see this kind of getting into any...
it's
wild. Do you think this could get into any type of potential like war?
I think it's a continent that's been at war for resources for a long, long time.
Mm.
It's already there. War is an undercurrent of every country in the world. It's been there. Again, every country in the world was built by war and taxation. Even the countries that are beautiful, like Bhutan, that are hugely peaceful, all the countries around them were at war, and their boundaries were defined by that as well.
Right.
It's really, really small, because they didn't fight back.
Hey,
I'm
British. Look at us. We're like
probably
the worst offender in the world. I think there's like 7 countries on the planet that we haven't been to war with. And that's probably where we did our banking.
Right.
Discuss.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that Nick, every time you come on, man, I'm just like, well, I'm glad you came on, because I'm like, that's a lot of information you threw at us there. And how do you get all this stuff? How do you distill this information down? Is it like,
what's your process?
It's a lot of research to put this together.
Yeah, so my process is, it's a scientific process. I set myself hypotheses around subjects that I'm interested in, which is typically around energy, transportation, urbanization, cities. It's around a whole bunch of different things. Education,
You must read a lot.
I read a lot. I easily read a dozen articles a day and skim read a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to a lot of people. I do my Exponential Minds podcast once in a while. I talk to tens of thousands of people every year at conferences, which is hugely enlightening for me. So I go and speak about agriculture, and there's nothing more educational than then speaking to like 20 different farmers over the course of an evening,
right,
to find out what they're talking about,
right,
then thinking about what that means, and you know, does that prove the hypothesis or not. So yeah, set the hypothesis, find the research that kind of proves, disproves it, and you can adjust it. I change my point of view and my opinion on a lot of things as I go through the year.
Right.
And generally what I do when I do keynotes or research reports is I'll write it and I'll let it sit and I'll keep reading and keep reading and I'll adjust it.
Make corrections.
And, you know, yeah. And hopefully there'll be some people in the room when I talk to them that literally walk out the door and go and do something different with their lives, or they change their businesses, or
right,
they just choose a brighter path for what they want to be.
Totally.
And it's happened. I had one girl came up to me after a keynote 2 years ago, and she was like, I can't work for these guys anymore, Nick. I said, you've opened my eyes. Thank you very much. It's really useful. I was like, oh, that's fantastic. I saw her 6 months later at the University of Waterloo. She goes, hey, Nick. I was like, oh, it's great to see you. She goes, yeah, I quit my job, and now I'm doing a technical entrepreneurship master's at University of Waterloo. Thank you for the inspiration. I'm like, blows me away.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's it. Changed course of life, and now I've built out a consultancy called Exponential Minds that works with the boards of directors and C-level executives to actually look at their organization and plan for the next 5, 10, 20 years. And it's started to really catch fire, because when you look at people like Elon Musk and you look at people like Jeff Bezos, you look at people that, you know, are shooting for Mars, and they're going further. They're trying to completely revolutionize how people think about how the world's going to work.
Mm.
And that's what a lot of organizations should think about.
Right.
Right.
Very cool.
Well, where can people reach out to you?
You can just find me on LinkedIn. I'm Nicholas Bampton. There's literally one of me in the world. There's a guy called Nick Bammons in South Africa, but you'll know the difference.
He's
when you
not
find
a futurist.
He doesn't look anything like me. And no, so you can find me there. You can contact me at nick@nicholasbammonton.com. Reach out to my website and whatever. There's a whole bunch of places.
Your website's your hub.
Sorry?
The website's the hub.
Website's my hub, nicholasbammonton.com.
Yep.
There's booking forms. If you've got a question or whatever, just come through the booking form and just say, cool. Hey, I heard you here, whatever. Always happy to chat. I'm busy, so I'm not always able to do it in person. It might just be an email sort of thing. But like, I try and see as many people as I can. Nice. It's getting tough, though.
Yeah. Well, thank you for jumping on.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank
that
you
was
always.
A great conversation. Super interesting. Looking forward to listening to it again to digest all of that, because there was a lot in there.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming on. And you're moving to Toronto. It saddens me a little bit because we have less access.
Yeah, so it's the idea. I spend most of my time in Toronto, Ontario, Ottawa, around there, out in Europe and across the States as well. It's a better hub for that. Mm-hmm. I love Vancouver. I've been here 10 and a half years. But I'm going to live in Toronto. I'm going to visit Vancouver often.
All right, well, when you're back in town, man.
Yeah, that's it. I'm still going to be here, and I'm going to be coming back, so that's all good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
And if you feel like you just drink from an information fire hose, which you kind of pretty much did, and you want to decompress from that a little bit, I highly recommend trying a flotation tank. If you'd like to give it a shot, you can go to the website floathouse.ca, book your session, and you can use the promo code VancouverReal. That will get you 20% discount on a single float. And that's all I got for now. So until next time.
To whatever is.
To whatever is.